Good morning. On today's programme, we hear from Pakistan, where climate change and corruption brought to the fore by floods during monsoon season threaten to submerge the country's largest city, Karachi. While in the Czech Republic, Russian military equipment captured by the Ukrainian army has gone on display to mixed opinion. But first, would you trust a bank that lost all your savings twice in the last 15 years, with your own personal stock of gold coins? That's what Zimbabweans are being asked to do as the authorities urge them to buy gold coins as a sure against inflation, now running at more than 191%. However, the cost of the coins is prohibitive for most of the population, and for those who can afford them, there remain concerns over the legitimacy of the scheme. From Harare, Ryan Truscott reports.
The number of Zimbabweans who will actually have the 676,000 Zimbabwe dollars to buy just one new gold coin from the central bank is, of course, minimal. That sum is equivalent to about 1,780 euros when a teacher here earns less than 198 euros a month. Poverty rates have risen in the southern African country following COVID and the fast ballooning economic crisis, the second crisis many here have known since 2008, when inflation reached 231 million%. At the last official count by Zimbabwe's statistics agency, inflation reached 191.5% in June. Zimbabwe's local dollar now trades at nearly 760 to 1 US dollar on the black market. Back in 2017, the rate was very nearly 1 to 1. All those Zimbabweans who are able to trade their Zimbabwean currency for US as fast as possible, often through a complicated network of illegal money changers, since it's almost impossible to buy foreign currency in a bank or on the official weekly foreign currency auction unless you're extremely well connected. And then, more often than not, they hide their stocks of US dollars at home, under the mattress, or in other hiding places, because they just don't trust the banks anymore. The thing is, there simply aren't enough US dollars going around to meet demand, even on the black market, and that's partly why these gold coins are being introduced next week, ostensibly to ease pressure on the US dollar. The central bank says the coins will be called Mosio Tunya, the indigenous name for the Victoria Falls. Each coin will weigh around 31 grams and consist of locally minted 22-carat gold. Gold is, to put it bluntly, a bit of a minefield here. Production has gone up. This year, Zimbabwean miners are set to produce 40 tons of gold, up from 21 tons last year. But the growth in the sector comes at the cost of a lawless and often violent backstory. The gold industry is dominated by small-scale miners. In areas like Kwekwe in central Zimbabwe, bands of lawless machete-wielding thugs known as Mashurugwi or Makorokoza fight each other, sometimes to the death, for control of mining claims. Local press reports claim some of these miners are in the pockets of politically connected individuals. This week, the private Newsday paper reported that Sean Mnangagwa, one of President Emmerson Mnangagwa's twin sons, is embroiled in a fight to control gold mining claims around the eastern gold mining town of Penalonga. NGOs say in nearby Udzi district, school children are dropping out of school to go and pan for gold, just as children dropped out of school to mine for diamonds in the Marangi district in 2008, which was, of course, at the height of the last hyperinflation crisis. Locals are already suspicious that the authorities want to use the market for gold coins as a way of forcing miners to accept only Zimbabwe dollars as payment for the mineral, since that's the currency the coins will be sold for. Currently, the miners are paid in foreign currency, and any attempt to take that payment away from them will be met with stiff resistance. Prospective Zimbabwean coin buyers are also worried they'll be shortchanged by the central bank, that each coin won't contain the 31 grams of gold it's supposed to. That fear speaks to the problem at the heart of Zimbabwe's battered economy, a lack of trust. After repeated crises, many Zimbabweans don't trust their government, don't trust their president, and don't trust their central bank. They don't trust rival miners on mining claims. They aren't sure they can trust those they illegally change money with. And they certainly don't trust their banks after years of bank queues and disappearing savings. In gold we trust, some say, but in Zimbabwe, not so much. For World Report in Harare, Zimbabwe, this is Ryan Truscott.
Next to Pakistan, where climate change and corruption threaten to submerge the country's largest city, Karachi. Since the monsoon season began last month, at least 29 people have died after flooding brought about by the intense rain. However, many of these deaths in this city of 20 million people were not directly caused by the floods, rather they were due to inadequate infrastructure, which has seen long periods of underinvestment. Critics say it's not capable of withstanding the effects of regular excessive rainfalls, which are becoming more intense from one monsoon season to the next. From Karachi, Hannah McCarthy reports.
Rain pelted down on the car roof as my taxi driver drove slowly through the 12 inches of rain that had submerged much of central Karachi last week. The next morning I opened the door of my hotel room and found the hallway wet from the monsoon rain that had raged all night. Outside the road was empty, but for a solitary man wading through the knee-high water. When the flooding eventually receded in the seaside neighbourhood of Clifton, what was left was more of an obstacles course than any sort of practical road or pavement. People carefully navigated the pools of water, sludge and open drains. So far, 29 people have died due to flooding since the monsoon season began in Karachi last month, including 8 who were electrocuted when pools of rainwater and dislodged electricity cables met and formed a lethal shock. "I'm 27 years old," said local Nasir, "and it's been the same every year. The government never does anything to protect the city. Everyone's corrupt." Karachi is a sprawling metropolis of 20 million people by the Arabian Sea, which serves as the commercial engine of Pakistan. Despite the city's importance to the national economy, sustainable growth has never been a political priority. Rapid climate change is now threatening to drown the city. Some experts warn that if sea levels continue to rise at their current rate, Karachi could be completely submerged by 2060. Shaukat Ali, a meteorologist in Islamabad, has described how winds driving the monsoon rains from the Bay of Bengal appear to be shifting towards Karachi and away from the agricultural lands of Punjab. This means that Karachi will likely face shorter and more intense rainfall over the coming years. Karachiites are particularly vulnerable to the effects of extreme weather. The majority earn less than $5 a day and live in informal settlements known as Kachi Abadis. Most of these settlements lack running water pipes, not to mention flood defences. Local activist Abira Ashfaq says that a lack of planning by the state has made the effect of climate change intolerable. "Our disaster management authorities have not played a constructive role." Karachi is ethnically and politically diverse, with a bloody history of sectarian feuds. Different areas of the city, as well as the provincial and federal governments, are controlled by different factions. Virtually all of these groups have entered into deals with builders who have prioritised profit over sustainable development. Karachi has only 2 landfill sites located 40 kilometres from the city's eastern outskirts, which makes transport costs prohibitively expensive. Any items that can't be recycled are often discarded in the rivers and streams that form the city's natural drainage system. Green spaces have vanished from the city, and hard, grey concrete and high-rise blocks have taken their place. Urban development specialist Farhan Anwar believes that the heavy concretization of the city has had disastrous consequences for the city's ability to withstand flooding. Open spaces serve as infiltration beds, and water runs down through to the ground. "Without the natural open ground, the city cannot absorb the intense monsoon rainfall that comes every summer," he says. Some efforts have begun to regenerate Karachi's green spaces and make it more resilient in the face of flooding and extreme heat. Masood Lohar created the Clifton Urban Forest as a tiny green lung in the concrete of Karachi. The forest is more of a wild park in its size, but it's full of the sound of singing birds, in sharp contrast to the busy traffic on most streets. Green spaces like this regenerate the biodiversity that has been lost from the city and absorb heat and heavy rain. Along Karachi's coastline, activists are also trying to protect the mangrove swamps, which have long served as important flood defences. By sequestering carbon, mangroves help slow climate change and protect locals against rising sea levels and increasingly severe storms. Local architect Tariq Kossir describes mangrove swamps as Karachi's air conditioning and oxygen supply. "If you just increase the mangrove cover, Karachi's next 30 years will be much better than if you build over them." Mangroves and forests are no doubt an attractive symbol of hope for many. But the cold, or rather extremely hot, reality is that without winning its battle against corruption, Karachi is unlikely to keep its head above water in its war against climate change. For World Report, I'm Hannah McCarthy in Karachi.
Finally today, we go to the Czech Republic, where Russian military equipment captured by the Ukrainian armed forces has gone on display in the capital, Prague. The display, including a damaged tank and a howitzer, stands as a reminder of the terrible toll of Russia's war against the country, but also of the vital importance of Western arms supplies in fighting back. The exhibition, unveiled by Ukraine's Minister of Internal Affairs, has drawn a steady stream of visitors. However, there's been some unease voiced in the Czech press as to whether it's appropriate to show the vehicles. From Prague, Rob Cameron has more.
Letna Plain is a large, dusty, open space a short distance from Prague Castle. Not far away are both the Technical Museum and the Museum of Agriculture, which are crammed with steam engines, trains, tractors and other pieces of hulking metal. But it's the modest collection of Russian military kit standing out in the summer sunshine that's making the headlines. The display of war trophies, including a damaged T-90 tank, a Buk air defence system and a howitzer, was unloaded from trailers last weekend and will stay here for another week. The exhibition was unveiled by Ukraine's Minister of Internal Affairs, Denis Monastirsky, alongside his Czech counterpart and other officials, including a European commissioner and the mayor of Prague. It's since drawn a steady stream of visitors. Children clamber over the rust-covered and blackened chunks of metal, no longer a threat to anyone after being knocked out by Ukrainian artillery shells or anti-tank weapons. People take selfies and artistic photos, lining up the tank's turret with the castle or the orange moon in the background. There's been some unease voiced in the Czech press as to whether it's appropriate to show the vehicles. Presumably, their destruction was accompanied by the deaths of the Russian servicemen manning them. But these have been swiftly cast aside. After all, those Ukrainians, soldiers and civilians, are facing daily horrors at their receiving end thanks to Russia's unprovoked war. It's not the first such exhibition, and not even the first outside Ukraine. After Kyiv, a similar display has already been held in Warsaw. Others are planned for Germany, France, the Netherlands, the US and the UK, as the Ukrainian government fights not just a brutal invader, but the threat of losing the West's attention. For now, there's little sign of that happening in the Czech Republic. The country has been one of Ukraine's earliest and most muscular supporters. The Czechs were the first to send tanks to Ukraine, T-72 main battle tanks from the Czech Army's active reserves. It's since sent more heavy weapons, including Mi-24 attack helicopters. However, the transfers, a combination of donations and arms purchases, are shrouded in strategic ambiguity. Even after the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin publicly thanked Prague for sending its helicopters to Kyiv, the Czech Defense Ministry maintained what amounted to a diplomatic silence. Photos of the helicopters bearing Ukrainian livery have since appeared on open-source intelligence sites on Twitter, apparently after being deployed to the battlefield. But there are fears as to the knock-on effect of rising energy and food prices caused in part by the conflict. If increasing numbers of Europeans are faced with a choice between heating and eating this autumn, their governments may feel under greater pressure to end the conflict, with all that could mean for Ukraine's borders. Ukrainian officials say they do not believe that will happen, and they're keen to use every opportunity not just to remind the world of Russia's brutality, but also of its weakness. As one Ukrainian government minister told me, Russian propaganda likes to scare Europeans that their tanks can reach Warsaw, Prague, Berlin. This exhibition proves, yes, but only as scrap metal. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Well, that's our lot for this morning. Thanks for staying with us. If you want to listen back to the programme, you can do so at rte.ie/World Report. The editor of World Report is Elaine Devlin. We're back at the same time next week. Until then, from me, Angus Cox, and all the team, take care.